The Baron shrugged again, not nonchalantly, but with a certain helplessness.
When we think about taking Coruscant at sea, we're talking about fighting someone else's kind of war, he said. I'd love the chance to face them on land, no matter what kind of ridiculous stories we're hearing out of Coruscant. But at sea, there's no way we can match their experience and training any more than they could match ours in a cavalry melee. Until we've had a chance to build up some experience, it's going to stay that way, too.
Coleman managed not to swear again, although it wasn't easy. On the other hand, one of the good things about Jarus, aside from the fact that he was family, was that he was willing to speak his mind plainly, at least to Coleman. And he had a point. To be honest, the Duke had never been overly impressed with his cousin-in-law's military prowess, but Jarus had one of the Desnarian Empire's better brains when it came to managing anything which had to do with trade, shipping, or manufactories. Well, one of the better aristocratic brains when it came to dealing with such matters, but that was pretty much the same thing. It was, after all, unthinkable that anyone who wasn't an aristocrat should be given the sort of authority the Admiral General of the Navy required. It was a testimonial to Coleman's inherent mental flexibility that he was even vaguely aware that there might have been a non-aristocrat somewhere in Desnare with more expertise in those matters than he or Jarus possessed. The very notion would never have occurred to the vast majority of his fellow nobles, and it never occurred even to Coleman that anyone except a nobleman should hold his or Jarus's current offices. The sheer absurdity of such an idea would have been sufficient to keep it from crossing his brain in the first place. And if someone else had suggested it, he would have rejected it immediately, since it would have been impossible for that theoretical common-born officer to exercise any effective authority over subordinates so much better born than he was. But the fact that Jarus had what was probably the best brain available when it came to the problems involved in building a navy from scratch didn't necessarily mean he was really up to the task. For that matter, in Coleman's estimation, the Archangel Langhorne might not have been up to this task.
"I don't disagree with anything you've just said, Erwin," the Duke said after a moment. "Langhorne knows we've discussed it often enough, at any rate. And it's not anything we haven't warned His Majesty and the Bishop Executor about either. But that's still not going to solve our problem when the Emperor and Bishop Executor Martin hear about this."
Jarus nodded. The good news was that Emperor Maris and the Bishop Executor were in Gaera, 1,300 miles from Coleman's Ithria office. There were times when that physical distance between Coleman's headquarters and the Imperial Court worked against them, especially given the nasty infighting which so often marked Desnarian politics. Rivals had much easier and quicker access to the Imperial ear, after all. On the other hand, most of those rivals had quickly realized that despite the enormous opportunities for graft inherent in building a navy from scratch, it was likely to prove a thankless task. However optimistically belligerent Emperor Maris and, especially, Bishop Executor Martin might be, Jarus doubted that any Desnarian aristocrat ever born could possibly look forward to the notion of fighting the Corisian Navy at sea. No one who'd ever done that had enjoyed the experience, a point which had been rather emphatically underscored by what the Corisians had recently done to the combined fighting strength of five other navies. Under the circumstances, while Coleman's enemies would undoubtedly seize upon any opportunity to damage his credibility with the crown with unholy glee, they'd be careful not to do it in a way which might end up with them being chosen to take his place. For that matter, Jarus's position, despite his far less lofty birth, was even more secure. In fact, if he'd been able to think of any way to avoid it himself in the first place, he would have done so in a heartbeat. But at least the sheer distance between them and Gaera gave them a pronounced degree of autonomy, without rivals or court flunkies constantly peering over their shoulders. So the two of them were far enough away from the imperial capital and well enough insulated against removal to be reasonably confident of not simply surviving their monarch's anger, but retaining their current positions.
Oh, joy, he thought ironically. Let's be honest, Divan, he said out loud. Nothing is going to make the Emperor or the Bishop Executor any less angry about what's happened to Wellar. That's a given. In fact, I think we should use this to underscore the fact that we've always warned everyone we're bound to get hurt, at least initially, going after Carizians in their own element. We're not the only ones who know Wellar or who understand his reputation as a good commander is well-deserved. All right, let's make that point to His Majesty, that one of our better commanders, with two of our best vessels under his command, was defeated by a single Carizian galleon in less than 45 minutes of close action. Don't blame him for it, either. In fact, let's emphasize the fact that he fought with great gallantry and determination. For that matter, as far as I can tell from this Captain Yearley's message, that's exactly what Wellar did. Tell the Emperor we're making great progress in building the Navy, but that it's going to take a lot longer to train it. Coleman frowned thoughtfully. There was a great deal to what Jarrus had just said. In fact, the economies of the Gulf of Jarrus and Marossa Bay had attained an almost Carizian bustle since the Church of God Awaiting had begun pouring money into the creation of shipyards there. Skilled carpenters, smiths, rope makers and sail makers, lumberjacks, seamstresses, gunpowder makers, foundry workers, and farmers and fishermen to provide the food to feed all of them had swarmed into the area. The locals might not think much of the Harchong advisors who'd been sent in to, theoretically, help them, but they'd buckled down with a will to the task itself, propelled by an enthusiasm built almost equally out of religious zeal and the opportunity for profit.